Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Jason Harris. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Bryson Katona, MD, PhD. He is director of the Gastrointestinal Cancer Genetics Program and director of the Gastrointestinal Cancer Risk Evaluation Program with Abramson Cancer Center at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Dr. Katona joins me today to talk about hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome. HDGC is associated with mutations in the CTNNA1 gene or the CDH1 gene and affects 1 to 3% of people with gastric cancer. HDGC typically affects young people and is extremely difficult to diagnose in the early stages. The only treatment is prophylactic total gastrectomy, and patients are advised to undergo the surgery by the age of 30. Dr. Katona is currently leading the CAFE study, which is attempting to identify the risk for HDGC in families who carry CTNNA1 mutations. In the long term, he hopes that data from this study informs screening and management of HDGC.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Katona. I appreciate your time today.
Of course, yeah. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So just to start from the beginning, exactly what is hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome?
So hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome, or also called HDGC for short, is really it's an inherited cancer predisposition syndrome that increases the risk of gastric cancer, but specifically increases the risk of diffuse gastric cancer. This syndrome was actually first identified, or at least the genetics of this syndrome was first identified in the late 1990s when the CDH1 gene was identified. And since that time, there's been another gene called the CTNNA1 gene that our group has done a lot of work on that has also been associated with this hereditary cancer predisposition syndrome.
Is it fair then to call this not exactly a new disease, but it's certainly been newly identified?
Correct. The families have been recognized for some time with hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome, but really it's only recently that the genetics of this disease has been worked out.
Is that just because it's so rare that nobody thought to look, or it's difficult to find? Or I guess why did it take so long to identify?
Yes, that's a great question. Well, as with many of these hereditary cancer predisposition genes, really the technology that allowed the identification of the genetic etiology really didn't come on the scene until the 90s. So, you know, many of these syndromes have been recognized clinically for decades, but it just took a while for technology to catch up to allow us to effectively identify them from the genetic standpoint.
I know you're a specialist in gastroenterology, but how did this specific and very rare disease come to your attention?
Well, yeah, I started actually studying digestive cancers during my PhD when I was at Washington University in St. Louis, and continued to study digestive cancers from the laboratory side throughout my gastroenterology fellowship. And it was during that time that I actually spent time doing some specialized training in cancer genetics. And it was during that extra training during my fellowship that I started to encounter some of these hereditary diffuse gastric cancer families, and seeing all the individuals that were affected, all the trials and tribulations that the families had to go through with regard to this condition, really just brought that condition to the forefront of my mind and really ensured that it was a continuing part of my ongoing research efforts.
Penn has a dedicated HDGC program. Is that because of your research, or is that what attracted you to University of Pennsylvania?
So I was one of the people who was originally involved in setting up our HDGC program at Penn. And, you know, we really started the program because we were seeing an increasing number of these families who were identified through genetic testing. And treatment and care for HDGC families is very complex and really requires a multidisciplinary team. And so I think that having a dedicated program where you have a dedicated group of specialists who deal with HDGC on a regular basis is really critical to ensuring the optimal care for our patients. So our HDGC program at Penn involves gastroenterologists, genetic counselors, surgeons, oncologists, nutritionists, endocrinologists, and several other subspecialties as well. But really, to provide comprehensive care for these HDGC families, you really need this multidisciplinary team of specialists.
Is this a disease that's particularly complicated to treat, or is that what the treatment regimen looks like for most cancers at Penn?
No, it's a condition where there are a lot of nuances to management. So it's not cut and dry, you know, black and white answer for every patient that comes through the door. There are a lot of nuances that need to be discussed, and ultimately, which, you know, we can talk about in more detail later, but many of these patients end up going a prophylactic removal of their stomach. And after a big surgery like that, there are certainly, you know, many other nuances and different types of monitoring that need to be done in a specialized setting.
Early detection is key to the treatment of most cancers, but HDGC is really impossible to detect in its early stages. Why is it so difficult to find?
You know, that's a great question. And really one of the hallmarks of hereditary diffuse gastric cancer is basically diffuse gastric cancer, but the precursor to diffuse gastric cancer in these patients are these small focuses of signet ring cells. And these are tiny little microscopic focuses that really can only be seen under the microscope and can't be detected by any other type of diagnostic modality. So we can't see them on endoscopy, they can't be picked up on a CT scan or a PET scan. And really, it's these small focuses that are thought to eventually blossom into a full-blown cancer, but it makes it very difficult when we don't have a way to actually effectively detect them. There have been many studies where patients with HDGC have gone through an upper endoscopy with lots of biopsies taken throughout the stomach, and despite all of these biopsies, when these individuals then undergo surgery, we'll still find multiple focuses of signet ring cells. And so this is an area where we don't have a good way to detect them basically without doing a full surgery, but it's an area of continuing active research, as we definitely could utilize methods that would be able to detect these signet ring cells at an earlier stage or at a more predictable rate.
You speak about research. I know you just won a $250,000 grant a few months ago to fund your research. So exactly what are you looking to study with that funding?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, we were very fortunate to have been awarded this grant from the Di Gregorio Family Foundation. We were just so thrilled that they were excited about our work in HDGC. So really this grant is focused on carriers of CTNNA1. Mutation. So this is one of the two genes that can cause hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome. The CTNNA1 gene is kind of the newer of the two genes, and one that our group has done a lot of work on, and we're actually seeing these genes detected in families at increasing rates. So the goal of our grant was really twofold. The main goal was really to establish the cancer risks associated with CTNNA1 carriers. And so as of now, we think that these genes are associated with gastric cancer risk and breast cancer risk, but we don't have any really good estimates of what that risk is. And we also don't have any good estimates or knowledge about whether there are other cancers associated with this gene. And so really the hallmark initiative of our study is that we're going to start a study called the CAFE study, or the CTNNA1 familial expansion study. This is a study that we've got it posted on clinicaltrials.gov already, and we'll be recruiting families with CTNNA1 mutations really worldwide to collect information about their personal and their family histories so that we can get a better handle on what are the cancer risks associated with this gene. We also have active collaborations with, at least in the United States, all of the genetic testing labs that are doing testing for CTNNA1 to really help bolster enrollment for this study. And so I think at the end of the day, we hope that by collecting families with CTNNA1 mutations, we'll really be able to get a much better sense of what the cancer risks are and what different types of cancers these individuals may be affected with, which ultimately, in the end of the day, will really help with how we manage these patients, what kind of screening we do for them, what type of preventative surgeries they may or may not need. So I think it'll be really helpful for informing that future care for how we manage these families.
Do you know yet who should undergo genetic testing for the CDH1 mutation or CTNNA1?
you know, this is an area where I think our threshold for testing patients for these mutations is definitely getting lower and lower. And I think that that is because we're just doing more and more genetic testing as it's getting cheaper and easier to do. There are criteria for who should undergo genetic testing for HDGC, which, you know, really should include CDH1 and CTNNA1. These are all published in, and there are some HDGC guidelines that are out there with the specific indications that are out there and published. But there are family criteria. So for example, one of the family criteria would be if you have a family where there are two cases of gastric cancer within the family, with at least one of those cancers being a diffuse gastric cancer. In that situation, then individuals in that family should definitely consider undergoing genetic testing. There are also individual criteria. So if any individual has a diffuse gastric cancer, you know, prior to age 50, that's kind of a definite indication that individual should undergo genetic testing as well. And there are about 10 different criteria can be used to determine who should undergo testing for HDGC.
So are there other cancers or other clinical findings that are associated with HDGC?
That's a great question. And, you know, really so much of the talk with HDGC is the gastric cancer risk, but there are other cancers associated with this syndrome, the major one of which is lobular breast cancer. So in terms of breast cancer, lobular is actually the less frequently seen type of breast cancer. Ductal breast cancer is seen more frequently. But lobular breast cancer, the risk in HDGC families can be up to 30 to 50% over the course of a lifetime. So it's a very, very high risk of lobular breast cancer. There's also been some thought that colorectal cancer risk may be increased in these families. However, at this time, we don't recommend any increased colon cancer screening for these families in the absence of a family history of colon cancer. And I think the other interesting thing that has been associated with HDGC families is having a cleft lip or a cleft palate. And actually, we see that oftentimes in families, and approximately about 15% of HDGC families will have some family history of cleft lip or cleft palate.
And is that related to the CTNNA1 gene or CDH1?
So at this time, we think that that's all related to the CDH1 gene. Hopefully with our CAFE study, we'll be able to have a better sense of whether or not the lobular breast cancer risk and the cleft lip and cleft palate risk are associated with CTNNA1, because this time we really don't have enough data on that gene to know.
If I'm understanding correctly, part of what your study is going to help establish is the lifetime risk for people with the gene, because I've seen a risk rate from as high as 70% to as low as 37%. So has there been an established kind of lifetime risk just yet?
The risk in cancer risk in hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome is actually that lifetime risks have actually been decreasing over time. And I think much of that had to do with the initial cancer risk estimates that were generated were generated from these families where there was just highly penetrant disease, where there were so many individuals with gastric cancer. But as we've been doing genetic testing, what we've actually been finding is we've been finding more and more individuals who carry a CDH1 mutation or a CTNNA1 mutation who actually don't have any gastric cancer in the family. And so when you start including those individuals who have the gene mutation but then don't have any gastric cancer in the family, when you start including those individuals in the risk estimate, overall the risk numbers end up coming down. And so I think that we see that very frequently with genetic cancer risk syndromes, especially as we test more broadly. But the risk estimates out there really are only for CDH1 carriers. And at this point, we really don't have any risk estimates for CTNNA1 carriers, which again is something that I think we will be able to at least provide an initial estimate for with our upcoming or currently recruiting CAFE study.
Earlier, you had mentioned prophylactic total gastrectomy, which is stomach removal. Are there any other preventative measures for this condition, or is that kind of where the treatment is right now?
Yeah, when we think about gastric cancer prevention, Unfortunately, prophylactic total gastrectomy is really all we have for these patients. We can do screening on a regular basis with upper endoscopy, but we have not shown that we've been able to effectively identify cancer early. So really, the only thing that we have is total gastrectomy. You know, other things, other cancer preventive agents, you know, we don't have any good medications to prevent cancer. You know, there are no specific dietary changes. I think, you know, of course, you know, we don't want these patients to smoke, but this is an area where we definitely need more research, because it seems like in this day and age, we would have something more to offer to these patients other than just prophylactic stomach removal. But unfortunately, we're not there yet.
What's the prognosis for patients following that surgery?
So from a cancer prevention standpoint, once the stomach is out, the risk of subsequent development of gastric cancer is zero. And so it is a, you know, from a surgical perspective, or from a cancer prevention perspective, the total gastrectomy is an incredibly preventative surgery. Now, total gastrectomy, though, is a very large surgery, and it's a very morbid surgery. It actually has some risk of surgical mortality by itself. And so there have been reports about, you know, 1%, you know, maybe a little bit more of individuals undergoing a total gastrectomy have mortality just related to the surgery itself. These individuals it's a long recovery. There are many risks in the short term that often can require additional surgeries. And there are many long-term risks as well, especially regarding nutrition. And the one that I find to be the most difficult to manage is actually changes in bone health over time, because the stomach is actually very important for helping individuals to absorb calcium. And so these individuals who have their stomach removed prophylactically, you know, and we're doing these surgeries in the 20s in patients nowadays, you know, I do worry about their long-term bone health down the road. So I think that, you know, while it is a great surgery from a cancer prevention standpoint, there are a lot of both short-term and long-term risks of the surgery, which make identification of individuals who want to undergo this surgery makes identification of appropriate individuals really necessary. These individuals, you know, have to be identified. They have to go through a lot of counseling, and, you know, we need to make sure that they're very good surgical candidates as well.
We talked earlier about how difficult it can be to just identify this disease in patients, but one of the potential, not treatments exactly, but annual endoscopic surveillance is an option for patients who want to postpone surgery. Have you had success in delaying treatment, and what are the risks, especially in a disease that can be so difficult to spot?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the risk in doing endoscopic surveillance and not pursuing surgery is always, of course, that a incurable gastric cancer could certainly pop up in the interim, since we are not very good at identifying these cancers at an early stage on upper endoscopy. But I do certainly think that there are some subgroups of patients where doing yearly endoscopic surveillance actually is appropriate. And so one is patients who have HDGC, but who are still young. And so usually we recommend total gastrectomy typically by age 30 or so, unless there was a family history of a very young onset stomach cancer. And so for many of our HDGC patients who are younger than age 30 and are, you know, delaying gastrectomy until closer to that time, we do follow them with annual upper endoscopy until they decide to undergo surgery. And I think it is very, you know, very reasonable to do that in that particular group. The other group where we do annual endoscopic surveillance is individuals with a CDH1 mutation or a CTNNA1 mutation where there's no family history of gastric cancer. And so actually current guidelines, if there's no family history of gastric cancer, but you carry one of the gene mutations, guidelines at this time don't recommend prophylactic gastrectomy. Definitely needs to be done. They kind of offer yearly surveillance in that case as well. And so I think those are two subgroups where it is reasonable to do endoscopic surveillance. However, in most other patients with HDGC, I think really I'm not super comfortable doing endoscopic surveillance over a long period of time because, again, I worry that those individuals may still develop an incurable gastric cancer even between surveillance exams.
So what then is the advantage to waiting for that subset of patients?
Yeah. So for the younger patients, you know, oftentimes it ends up being kind of a lifestyle factor. And so for younger patients, you know, maybe they're in school or, you know, maybe they're doing some, you know, additional graduate school. And a lot of times they wait until there's a good point in their life where they can take time off to have the surgery and to dedicate some time to healing and recovery afterwards. And so that's what I see for younger people most often. For, you know, again, older individuals who have HDGC, you know, I really don't think that there is any role for waiting. A lot of times it ends up being a personal preference, though, that the patient's just not comfortable with moving ahead with such a big surgery. But that being said, if we're doing annual endoscopic evaluations on these HDGC patients, you know, whenever we do the upper endoscopy, we take biopsies throughout the stomach. And if one of those biopsies were ever to come back with an early focus of signet ring cell cancer, really then the recommendation is total gastrectomy right then and there. And so I think patients who do get these annual endoscopies, you know, they do so knowing that if by chance a small focus of cancer is identified, the recommendation is really going to be to remove the stomach right at that point.
What's next for HDGC research?
Well, it's, you know, it's an exciting area. It's a growing area with growing research interest. I think that some of the big research questions that we need moving forward are really ways to detect these early focuses of signet ring cells better. We're still not doing a great job at it, but I think that's an area where we need to improve. I think some of the other research questions are developing methods to help predict who are the patients with one of these gene mutations who may be at the highest risk of gastric cancer. Because, you know, maybe we don't have to remove everybody's stomach. Maybe we just remove stomachs from the people that are at the highest risk. But at this point, we don't have good ways for defining or determining who's at the highest risk and who is not. And then I think from the laboratory side of things, what we really need to understand is what causes these small focuses of signet ring cells, because they'll oftentimes sit in the stomach for decades. But what is it that causes these small focuses of signet ring cells to really blossom into a full-blown invasive cancer? Because we don't really understand the initial steps in the biology of these small focuses of signet ring cells. And so I think there's many, many important questions that need to be asked. I hope that this is an area that, you know, we'll get increasing funding attention from, you know, NIH and other societies as well moving forward, we really just have a lot of important questions to answer.
Thank you, Dr. Katona, for joining us today. I appreciate you, your time and all your help.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yeah, I hope this is an incredibly important disease, and I hope for those listening that this was helpful information, and I look forward to continuing to work on this disease moving forward, and hopefully we'll have some better options for these patients in the future.
That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Bryson Katona, and thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.